This episode of The Green Piece is supported by my friends at Immersion Journeys, an award-winning tour consultant based in New York City and your source for experiential luxury travel to Africa, South Asia, and way beyond. The Immersion Journeys brand has been built on the foundation that more than the sights, it is the experience. Immersion Journeys is also a proud supporter of Sabi Sabi Private Game Reserve. Immersion Journeys focuses on conscious luxury with an emphasis on positive community and conservation impact through travel. Their deep partnerships with select lodge groups such as Sabi Sabi Private Game Reserve, their selection of professional safari guides and creative trip itineraries provides their guests with unique experiences bar none. For more information, please contact Immersion Journeys on telephone number 917-686-2620 or check out their website at www.immersionjourneys.com. That's immersionjourneys.com. You can also drop them an email at info@immersionjourneys.com. Thanks for tuning into The Green Piece, that's spelt P-I-E-C-E. I'm Warren Green, your host and one of the storytellers of this weekly podcast, where I'll be telling campfire stories about sustainable safaris, misadventures, and travel tales from around the world. I have a number of interesting people, including safari guides, conservationists, lodge managers, and philanthropists lined up to share their stories and expertise with you. So, grab yourself a beverage, sink back into a comfortable chair, and enjoy the next half an hour with me. The Green Piece has become a popular podcast and is attracting an audience that stretches beyond the travel industry and my friends around the world, which for me is incredibly satisfying. And I'm really pleased to see so many new people coming in and joining the listenership. So thanks very much for spending your time with me. My business, Warren Green & Associates, is all about promoting sustainable lodges and practices and companies around the globe. I feel that our planet is in desperate need of a little bit of saving, and the better we treat it, the better it will treat us and give back. So for me, sustainable practices are critically important to the health of our planet. Many of my clients are selected because of their commitment to sustainable practices, and I think that's coming through on the podcast that you are hearing. One of those clients and one of my friends in my portfolio is the company called Wild Horizons, whom I've got to know over the years and thoroughly respect for their commitment to sustainable practices, not just in creating an environment that supports wildlife and ecosystems, but an environment that employs people on a sustainable basis. When one talks about sustainability, we're also looking at aspects of construction and the way lodges are operated and run, making best use of solar energy, wind power, recycling water. The material that goes into building these camps is recycled as opposed to using hardwoods and that sort of thing. So this is where Wild Horizons has excelled. They operate four really wonderful lodges in the Victoria Falls region, Elephant Camp and Elephant Camp West, along with Old Drift Lodge and Imbabala Lodge closer up to the Botswanan border. Of course, they've got Lukat Cafe as well. Not only do they employ loads of people, but they run the transfer vehicles, they run some of the adrenaline activities in and around the falls, and more importantly, they're very, very involved in conservation practices, which I'm going to discuss today with Craig. And today it's a fascinating conversation because Wild Horizons landed with some elephants in their lap, and I don't think many of us can boast such a story. So today we're chatting to Craig White, who's the Chief Operating Officer of Wild Horizons. And while he and I are talking, why don't you open up your browser and have a look at their website? That's wildhorizons.co.za. You can also open up a second website, and that's VicFallsWildlifeTrust.org. For some more information on what they do there. These are two aspects of the conversation that we're going to be talking about today. So I think you might just find it a little bit more enjoyable with access to some of that data. Yeah, Craig. So I was looking at the news the other day, and that river seems to be flowing at extraordinary levels at the moment. I mean, is it the highest you've ever seen it?
No, Warren. It actually isn't. It is particularly high considering we had quite a poor flow last year. But 2007, 2008 was a particularly high year, the highest I can remember for a long time. Obviously, the biggest floods we've had were in 58 and then 10 years later in 68. 58 were the really big ones, you know, when Lake Kariba was being built and the cofferdams were washed away and we had all sorts of chaos. And then in 1968, we had very high floods again, but we've never seen anything like that. Even as I say, the 2007, 2008 floods, which I remember being very high, came nowhere near that height. But yeah, that's the highest I can remember it. And then again, 2017, 18 was a good year. But again, it was just slightly higher than this year. So yeah, we've had a good flow, but certainly not the highest it's been, but the highest it's been for a year or two. And we're very excited with what's happening. Eh?
So no breakfast and no lunches at Livingston Island right now?
No, it's all closed at the moment. Hey, there's lots of water coming over. It's spectacular. Really, such a pity that we're in the middle of the lockdown, but and no one can get to see it. It's really spectacular though.
So when the water's this high, I mean, obviously the falls itself is magnificent. I mean, and just two or three days ago, you would have had a full moon coming up over the highlands there, and seen that spectacular. Rainbow from the moon, which I've never seen and would love to. But when it's high like this, river activities, and let's just say under normal operating conditions, are they now curtailed? No more rafting, no more swimming, no more canoeing type stuff?
Yeah, you know, we go to high water rafting, which is actually very quick. It's not the adrenaline-fueled full day that we normally get in the low season. You know, low season is the best time to raft. When the water's quite low, the rapids are quite pronounced, water's very rough and quite exciting, but it's also flowing slow enough that you don't get these huge whirlpools and really dangerous areas, you know? So as the river's coming up, we go to a high water phase, and that's like a half day rafting, and then it gets to a dangerous level and we stop, and lots of whirlpools and stuff, and not great.
So when it's flowing that fast, you're still getting through what I think it's about 18 rapids that make the run from the falls down to the hike out of that gorge.
Yeah, look, it really depends. As it starts to get higher and higher, they start running from rapid 11 down to 23, and it's really just quite a dash down the river. It's fun if you've ever rafted before, but it certainly doesn't compete with the low water rafting, huh? And you go along pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, you're a man that should know, right? You were like one of the pioneers of the Zambezi River rafting.
No, there was actually my partner, Clive, who works with us in Wild Horizons. Clive is really the old man of the river, as we call him. I've always been involved on more the safari side, Warren, the lodges, the game activities, that type of thing. And Clive is specialized in our river activities.
Okay, so is he the engineer, or are you the engineer? One of you guys decided to wire the gorge for a drink.
Yeah, that was Clive. That was Clive. He's the wire man and the adrenaline freak. So the high wire is all his fault, really.
Well, I don't think it's anybody's fault. I think it's a magnificent development at Victoria Falls, which has fast become known as one of the adrenaline capitals of the world. But you guys also specialize in a wild ride of another kind, and that's the Upper Zambezi, where you take sunset cruises and sunrise cruises out of the Old Drift Lodge, just on the banks, the southern bank of the Zambezi.
Correct. Yeah. We built Old Drift Lodge. It's been open for 2 years now, Warren. Really very proud of it. Quite a spectacular property. Just a 5 or 6 kilometers into the Zambezi National Park, which runs, you know, about 30 kilometers upriver along the Zambezi towards the Botswana border. And Old Rift is situated on the banks of the river within the park in a particularly game-rich area. And yes, we do lovely boat cruises from the lodge itself, as well as walking safaris and game drives and various other things that you would normally traditionally do in a safari lodge.
Yeah, I was supposed to come and visit Shane. Well, it would have been last week. We were going to have a little get together and a meeting about the state of affairs at the lodge itself, but obviously that didn't come to pass. I last saw Old Rift a week or so after it had opened, and I was it the year before? I was absolutely stunned by the location. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about that spot called the Old Rift, because I'm fairly fascinated by some of the historic novels of the great safari and hunting days of Africa. And I gather that was a major crossing point to get from the south to the north, crossing the Zambezi River.
Yeah, correct, Warren. We took the name Old Rift Lodge from the name that they had actually given the crossing point over the Zambezi. Now, a drift, as you know, is just a name for a crossing on a river. And this was one of the few areas. There are a couple a little bit above the falls itself. There's another crossing point. There's the Old Drift crossing, and then further up the Zambezi towards Botswana, there's a couple more. But this was one of the most famous ones and the most well-utilized. And so basically what happened is people who were traveling from South Africa up through southern Rhodesia, as it was known at that time, into northern Rhodesia, which is Zambia. When people were traveling up that way, they would cross over the Zambezi at the Old Drift point. So they'd come up along what was known as the Old Hunter's Road, which was the boundary between Zimbabwe and Botswana, hit the Zambezi River up near Kasani in Botswana, and then come slightly down towards the falls, find the crossing point, and then go across. And at Old Drift, the river's quite wide, but it's very shallow. A lot of rocks and rapids going across the water there. And they would float the ox wagons, the oxen would swim across. So it was a nice shallow point where they could get across onto the other side.
Must have been quite a spectacle, and I suppose for those trekkers themselves, quite harrowing, because there's a huge population of crocodiles up that stretch of river, right?
No, for sure, absolutely. So I'm sure they had lots of hairy moments trying to get across the river. The actual The Old Drift itself was located on the northern banks of the river, actually in Zambia, where Livingstone Town originally was placed. Unfortunately, people didn't know a lot about malaria in those days, so a lot of the early settlers died off from, you know, their black water fever. Malaria, living so close to the water. So life expectancy wasn't great for people living in that area, and eventually, they moved the town to the current site of Livingstone at the moment in Zambia, and they closed the Old Rift down purely because it was just such a difficult place for people to survive with the malaria that was, you know, on the river.
That's amazing, because I mean the town is not exactly so far away. I mean, it's 15 kilometers in from the river itself.
Correct, but it's a lot higher. So you know, it's the low-lying areas with the water pushing up into the shallower areas where the mosquitoes were breeding on the water that really was quite dangerous. And as you got away from the river and up into the higher land, the mosquitoes were less of a threat, huh?
Yeah. What we have today with knowledge is incredible. Now listen, you white brothers have ended up in Victoria Falls and have become quite a tourism force up there, not only with your Old Rift Lodge, but the elephant camps as well. How did you guys end up there?
Warren, good question. We came here when we were fairly young. I must have been probably 4 or 5 years of age. Shane was even younger than that, my younger brother Shane. And our parents settled here. We had been in northern Rhodesia or Zambia, and then we'd come back out of there at independence back down into Zimbabwe. And for some reason, my parents decided to resettle from the center of the country up onto the Zambezi. My dad was always a great fisherman, so I'm sure the lure of the Zambezi had something to do with that. We came up here, and our father actually worked for the government at the time. His job was to supply the village of Victoria Falls with water. And part of that that job was also going out into Wangi National Park, the surrounding Zambezi Chumabonda National Parks, and keeping what were known as game watering supplies going. So in Zimbabwe, particularly Wangi National Park, the park was always very dry, and a whole series of boreholes were drilled and water was pumped so that we could supply animals with water in the dry season. And part of my dad's job was actually to do that. And as kids, we used to accompany him into the national parks. And I suppose that's where our love of wildlife started, making sure these game watering pans were pumped all the time and the animals had water in the dry season. And Shane and I grew up around wildlife while we were kids with our sister Shay. And I suppose that's where we really started, you know?
Yeah, man, that must have been fascinating, because I know today, I keep an eye on Dave Carson and his activities up in Wangi and all those guys who are operating lodges up there, and they're forever on a drive to raise money to support borehole delivery and water holes up in the Wangi area. So does that imply that what your dad started has progressed and has enabled a larger population of game, or is it just a natural progression of maintenance and keeping that park in good order?
Well, you know, Warren, initially when Ted Davison, the first warden of Wangi, established Wangi National Park, it was really just a dust bowl. You know, it's part of the huge Kalahari sand system. If you go drive through parts of Wangi, it's huge, deep Kalahari sand beds, very little surface water. And, you know, when he was given the task of going out and creating a national park or a game reserve, as they used to be known as, there was no water. And it was within the first year or two that Ted Davison realized that if he was going to keep any wildlife in the area, he'd have to put in some water. You know, it was great in the rainy season when all the little depressions and the water courses captured water from the rains. But as soon as the rains disappeared for 9 months, the animals disappeared too, and most of them moved either northwards up towards the Zambezi system, across west into Botswana, across to the Chobe, and the Okavango system, which held water throughout the year. And Wangi had very, very little permanent wildlife until they started drilling wells. You know, initially they didn't have the borehole technology of drilling very deep. They would dig wells, expose water, try and make them the sides shallow enough that animals could get to it. And eventually, you know, they would put in hand pumps and pump out water, and the system developed from there. So, as you say, the technology's changed. It was always diesel pump driven. They had windmills right at the very beginning. Then it was diesel pump driven. That's fairly expensive and high maintenance to keep those things going. And now a lot of work's being done with solar. You know, fortunately, the technology's really improved and the solar panels are great. And we're pumping a lot of water by solar now, you know, which is environmentally friendly. It's much more cost effective and less maintenance. So, yeah, a good thing going on in the park. Dave and lots of the other operators are doing some great stuff in there. But as you know, always raising money is an issue. So it's a bit of an uphill struggle, but we get there in the end.
Yeah, so the water's obviously been a key issue in developing the Wangi National Park, and it is a national park. Was it just is it a area under conservation? Has it got status?
Absolutely, no. It's a national park. It's 14,000 square kilometers, so a magnificent park. Been there for a very long time. I think it was 1938 that it was first established. So been around a long time, Warren, and a magnificent park.
And I mean, so old man White was responsible for hydrating the park, and then come in the brothers a few years later and start a camp there. Were you one of the pioneer sort of camp managers or camp owners with, is it Jijima Camp?
Jijima, yeah, we had Jijima Camp. Now, Jijima was never actually inside Wangi National Park. It was just on the border of the park, you know. A lot's changed over the years since Shane and I first got involved. You know, we were just kids. I was 21, 22 years of age, fresh out of college and got involved in tourism. I'd spent a year in Botswana, first of all, Warren, you know, when I realized that I wanted to do something with wildlife, I thought, let me get across to Botswana and see a bit of the Okavango and and something different. So I spent a little bit over a year working in the Delta, and that was a magnificent learning experience for me. Absolutely loved my time there. But and eventually came back to form the original Wild Horizons with my dad. And we first of all started up on the Zambezi once again, a place called Imbabala, which is right at the confluence where the Chobe River comes in and meets the Zambezi, and where four countries come together. You know, only place in the world where four countries meet. So that had a bit of a draw card to it. Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe all meet together on one point in the river. And we created our first lodge, which we called Imbabala, and again, a national parks concession, an area of national parks that we leased from the government. And we built our first lodge there back in 1987, I think it was. And yeah, we've just grown the group since then, you know. We had one boat, one broken down old Land Rover, and that's how most of us start, I suppose.
Well, I tell you what, today I know the Wild Horizons group has got a little more than one broken down boat and one broken down Land Rover. In fact, I don't think broken down is an adjective that you would use to describe your fleet of terrifically comfortable coaches and minivans and executive motor cars and a blooming armada of cruising vessels that take people up and down the river. It's really a success story of note. But I suppose, talking success stories, you guys have also been thrown a few curveballs over time. We all know Zimbabwe's history and the ups and the downs that it's been through, and how this has impacted tourism. You know, it kind of makes COVID virus look like something you guys would normally just take in your stride. And I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, because there's been nothing like this that we've ever experienced. But I know Zimbabwean operators are a breed amongst themselves and are pretty conditioned to enduring hardships. And I think one of the hardships that you guys had, well, let me not call it a hardship, let's just call it a learning curve, was this introduction of elephants into your business. Not something that anybody anticipates having to deal with. How did you guys initially become the custodians of a herd of pachyderms?
Yeah, interesting question, Warren. And sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and I wonder myself, how did this happen? Again, as I said before, we started out as kids in the industry, really, you know, 21 years of age. What do you really know? But we were young, we were gung-ho. And as you say, yeah, you know, Zimbabweans, not a fairly tough breed, I suppose. We have had a lot thrown at us over the years. We had just come out of, you know, an independence struggle here for independence transition from Rhodesia to Zimbabwe. So we'd had some tough years there. The country was settling down quite nicely under new rule, the Mugabe administration. We had some great years. And somebody came along one day and said to me, you know, we were based here in Vic Falls. We had a small little company going. We had just started in Imbabala, as I said before. Had a couple of boats on the river, a couple of game drive vehicles. And one day, a gentleman by the name of Rory Hensman, who farmed in the northern part of the country, just north of Harare, in a place called Chinoy, he turned up in Vic Falls and knocked on my door and said, "I've got four elephants. Do you want them?" You know, of course, I looked at him like he'd gone a bit nuts and said, "Well, why do you have four elephants, and where'd they come from, and what do you want me to do with them?" And that's really where it started from. You know, we were young, impressionable. We didn't know anything really about working with elephants. Like everybody, we had always believed that only Asian elephants could be handled and worked with. We had heard vaguely of an American fellow called Randall Moore, who was in the middle of the Okavango Delta with some elephants that he had bought from a zoo in America. Other than that, we knew very little about elephants. And that's really where it started, Warren.
Well, while Craig gets up to adjust the logs in the campfire and open us another beer, why don't you take a look at wildhorizons.co.za. That's the Wild Horizons website. And also have a look at VicFallsWildlifeTrust.org. That's the sanctuary website. Welcome back, Craig.
we as a family, at that stage, we'd had Imbabala. We were just starting Jijima Camp, which is our lodge that we had down in Wangi National Park. Just started that when Rory turned up. And there was a great concern, to be honest, that if we didn't take the elephants and give them the right kind of lifestyle, they could have ended up in a much more precarious situation than they did. It was the new industry. Lots of excitement was being generated. Other people were looking in and saying, hey, let's do something, you know, in the falls. Yeah, long and the short of it is we went and had a look at these ellies, took them, went out for a ride on them. They were youngsters, 8, 9 years of age, little things. Went for a jump on their back. Went for
just
yeah.
At that age, how big is an elephant? I mean, I think people listening in are sort of hearing you say jumped on and rode an elephant. It's not like hopping on the back of a horse, is it? I mean, this animal is quite a little.
No. It's still big, eh? You know, probably 1.7, 1.8 meters. That we can give them the home they deserve, you know. There were quite a few elephants. Once we got involved in it, Warren, and a year or two later, we started to get quite involved in the elephant industry. We did a survey together with a group of other elephant owners in the country, and we identified 99 elephants that had come from culling operations, management operations that our parks board used to do in the 80s, late 70s and 80s, when part of a management tool was to actually reduce the populations of elephants in Wangi, Gonera Zoo, Mana Pools, those sort of big national parks where the populations of elephants were quite large. They would go in and cull them, you know, manage the populations. And basically, very controversial issue, not something that's practiced anymore, fortunately. And entire family units were, the babies were captured. They were sold to zoos. A lot of them went out of the country. 99 of them stayed within Zimbabwe that we could identify. And so the little group of four that we first started out with were part of that group of orphans from the culling period, where that had a pretty traumatic start to life, to be honest. And that's how we ended up with them. So we really wanted to try and give them something better. You know, they deserved a good place to go, some attention, some care. So we took them to Jijima, and that's really where the whole thing started.
Well, you know, that's courageous, because you were doing that at a time when there wasn't really a manual written on how to raise an elephant and what to do when the elephant gets colic type thing. So you guys were, I suppose, somewhat pioneering in this whole business. I remember, you know, at that time being raised in South Africa, our national parks down there were embarking on culling campaigns. They had this magical number, I think it might have been 11 or 12,000 elephants that was the optimal carrying capacity of the Kruger National Park, because it was an entirely enclosed national park, albeit the same size as Israel. It was still enclosed, and the elephants couldn't necessarily migrate out of the area should they need to. So they had this notion that the management of the park needed to control numbers, and they did that by culling. I remember in the early days when the Pilansberg National Park was evolving, the youngsters from the Kruger were relocated and reintroduced into the wild in the Pilansberg, and it was a god-awful mess. Those youngsters were ill-disciplined. They didn't have the family support structures, and they ran amok in the park, beating up rhinos, running into vehicles, destroying them. So they became technically problem animals, and I think, I don't know this for a fact, some of them were euthanized, but this whole culling program presented more problems than it solved, and it was pioneering conservation work. You know, people really didn't know the impact of what they were doing. Elephants live, as you just said, you know, up to 60, 70 years of age in the wild. And so for any one scientist, there's never been a conclusive study on the lifespan of an elephant, or been, you know, scientists haven't been able to observe continuously the life cycle of an elephant before, you know, the scientist dies type thing. So I think that at that time, the Cynthia Moss's book on elephants in the Amboseli was probably the closest we came to really understanding elephant behavior. So not necessarily material that you guys had at your fingertips to help you manage this orphaned orphanage that you were setting up. So yeah, I mean, kudos to you for jumping in and getting involved and trying to do something. So those four then started to run around Wangi.
We took them to Jujima, to Wangi, and Warren, as I said, they were fairly young, so and we were just in our infancy trying to learn what to do with these things. And basically, we just exposed them to tourists for a period of 2 years. You know, guests who were coming to Jujima to do traditional game drives, walking safaris, normal stuff that you would do in a safari camp in a national park. And we introduced the elephants to them. Guests would go out walking with them in the bush, watching the elephants interact with each other, interact with wild animals on the property, get to spend time with them, you know, feeding in the late afternoon, watching them in the early morning coming out of their stables. We used to keep them in huge big horse stables made out of gum poles for their own protection, because as still being, you know, 9-10 years of age, quite susceptible to lions and other predators. And it was quite a learning curve to see how taken guests were with getting up close and personal with an elephant. You know, it was never really our intention to get involved in elephant back safaris. We really wanted to try and give the elephants a better home, a better lifestyle, and ultimately be able to hopefully do a release with them. And as we progressed along with them, we realized, you know, feeding, looking after, housing, veterinary care for an elephant, it's a huge undertaking, to be honest, and something we hadn't really bargained for. And before we knew it, we had all sorts of big bills rolling in. You know, elephants of that age, they need constant supervision. If they're out in the bush just doing their own thing, you need guys, minders, who are out there with them, just watching where they go, not getting into trouble, not pushing over, you know, neighbor's fence somewhere, or chasing vehicles, or doing anything foolish, fighting with each other, getting into trouble with predators. So you have guys out in the bush with them, you have people tending to them in the evening. You know, elephants tend to spend 18 out of 24 hours munching on something, so they, you're putting in fodder during the night, you're making sure they've got water, you're having to meet the cost of veterinary bills when they hurt themselves. That kind of thing. And we pretty soon realized that we had bitten off a bit more than we could handle, you know. And as guests really talk to them, we thought, well, maybe we could do something a little different, you know. By this stage as well, you've got to realize that we were babes in the wood. We had absolutely no idea what we were doing. But after 2 years, we realized, you know, these young elephants had been captured at the age of 3, maybe maximum 4 years of age, you know, when they were just weaned. And since then, they'd been with people every day, every night of their lives. So they were fairly conditioned, or absolutely conditioned, to being around people. And consequently, over the years, the biggest hindrance we have found to a rehabilitation program is the fact that you've now taken a big animal like an elephant, you've desensitized it to humans. They've lost their inherent fear. You know, all wild animals are inherently fearful of humans. You know, we've been killing and doing horrible things to animals for such a long time that there are very few wild animals that look at us at that human form and don't bolt, you know, elephants included, even though they're so big.
Yeah.
And, you know, over a period of 6-7 years, these young elephants had become totally habituated to people. And now you say, well, okay, we're going to let you go into the wild. Well, the first thing they're going to do is seek out people, because you've fed them, you've given them water, you've given them social interaction. And that's the biggest problem. you know, if you can put elephants or any other wild animal into an area where they're not going to come into contact with people, you've got a fighting chance of rehabilitation. But the problem we have in the world, and that's, we go right back to why we were culling to start with. You know, there's not too many elephants in the world. There's too little land, Warren. And that's why places like Kruger and Wangi and Mana Pools and places like that ended up having to cull, because you're taking an area, even take Wangi National Park, 14,000 square kilometers. You say, wow, that's a big chunk of land, you know. Elephants, you live in that. Well, you know, as the population grows, where do the elephants go to? Traditionally, they would have migrated out of Wangi. They would have crossed the Zambezi. They would have gone up into Angola. They would have gone into Zambia. Those migratory routes have now been cut. There are villages encircling all these parks. There are towns. There are roads. There's human habitation, and that's the biggest problem we have in Africa at the moment, is there's too many of us, and, you know, not enough space for them. Mm. And so we get back to, okay, we've got four young elephants. What do we do with them? You know, we can't just take them to Wangi and let them go, because they'll soon wander out of that place. There's no fences keeping them in. There's people driving in and out. There's National Parks headquarters. There's activity, you know. And let me tell you, this was borne out. We've been down the road of release rehabilitation over the last 25 years. We've done a bit of that. We've learned the hard way. It's a very difficult thing to achieve, and you've really got to do it properly. So the next best thing was, let's create a haven for these four elephants. We had no idea that we were going to expand from four to ultimately, you know, at one stage we had 23 elephants on our hands, and we've probably had 47, 48 elephants over the years pass through our control. Yeah, and things rapidly grew. As the word got out that, you know, we were giving safe haven to elephants. And anyway, that's how we created the elephant camp. So we saw that you could do something with the elephants to educate people, to entertain people. I hesitate to say entertain, because I don't want it to sound like a zoo, but they're like baboons. They're damn entertaining animals to be around, you know? And you can certainly keep people enthralled with a herd of elephants. Just watching them interact with each other, their social structure, their interaction with other animals, the way they feed, the way they think problems through. They're fascinating animals, you know? They're certainly intelligent. And we realized, hey, let's create a special place just for them. So we built the elephant camp, which is originally about 25 kilometers outside of Victoria Falls. We built a very small little lodge, only took 8 guests, 4 rooms, and 4 elephants. So one room per elephant, fairly nice and intimate. And that's really where it started. We created this little paradise on a piece of property just outside Vic Falls. And I say paradise because for elephants, it was just wonderful. There was lots of food, thick forests, nice grasslands, lots of water, lots of space. So lots of other wild elephants and wild animals to interact with. So that's where the elephant camp came about.
How did you get them from Wangi to Vic Falls?
So what we had originally done is we had trucked them from Chinoy up to Wangi. But it was quite a harrowing journey. You know, anytime you've got to knock an elephant down, drag him into a crate, wake him up again, then transport him, you know, standing on his feet, obviously, in the back of a shaky truck. It's not the best experience in the world. Quite traumatic. And as we were only about 250 kilometers away, we thought, well, why don't we just make a walk out of it, a safari out of it, and see what the elephants are capable of. Learn a little bit from them. And so we set out. It took us 5 days, and we walked across country through the bush with the elephants. One of the most fascinating things that we've done in the time that we've had the elephants, Warren, just absolutely mind-blowing what you could ask an elephant to do and what he would do for you, you know, seemingly very, very happily, you know. Let's walk 250 kilometers. Okay, which way? And off we go, you know? And
I just pause there for a moment. I think of taking my 2 Jack Russells for a walk on a leash, and I can hardly keep them by my side. How do you get four elephants to at your side, sort of heel, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, they were all by this they were trained if you want to accept elephant grooms, elephant handlers. And they were used to the guys that really looked after them. You know, you've got to understand that the staff that we had working with the elephants at this time, most of them had been with the elephants probably 5, 6, 7 years, you know, and had created a real bond with them. The elephants trusted them. They trusted the elephants. And no rush. We've got as much time as we need. They stop and feed along the way. Every little river, water course we came to, they'd have a drink of water. A lot of the time, we had to walk down main public highways with traffic up and down. Fortunately, you know, our roads are not well traveled, but you'd certainly have, you know, 10 or 15 cars coming by every hour. Yeah. Elephants were just amazing, absolutely phenomenal. Sure, we created a real stir, you know. People came along and saw four elephants in a line with this whole circus of cars and people walking along with them. It really raised some eyebrows, but it was a fascinating time, a really incredible experience. And the Ellies, I hesitate to say, loved it, but they certainly didn't dislike it. And I tell you, it went incredibly well. And after 5 days, we arrived at Elephant Camp. They settled into their new home without a hitch. It was really eye-opening, Warren. It was an incredible time.
Well, while Craig gets up to adjust the logs in the campfire and open us another beer, why don't you take a look at wildhorizons.co.za. That's the Wild Horizons website. And also have a look at Vic Falls wildlifetrust.org. That's the sanctuary website. Welcome back, Craig. Yeah, you march on down, you arrive in Vic Falls, and you end up now at the Victoria Falls. What's the national park? New home, elephant camp.
Woodlands Estate, yes. It was known as Woodlands Estate, a piece of private land surrounded by national park. And wonderful place. So we created this little elephant camp, moved the elephants in, and then guests started to come and spend time at the elephant camp just to spend time with the elephants, just to do elephant things. So, you know, a typical day in the life, a guest would come, go out on safari on elephant back instead of in a jeep or on a boat cruise. You jump on an elephant and go for a safari on an elephant for an hour or so, you know, riding through the bush, walking up to other elephants, up to other wildlife. It was a wonderful experience. It really was, you know, a great way to see things differently. Most of the time, people were just walking with the elephants, watching them feed. The elephants were mostly roaming free during the day, Warren. So lots of free time, lots of just guest interaction, and just getting to learn all about, you know, what makes an elephant tick. And it proved really, really popular.
Yeah, I think the stigma around the elephant abuse is born in Asia, Southeast Asia, India, those countries where the elephant has become a workhorse and an income generator for families. I've seen it where they are, you know, they work from morning through to night, nonstop in dismal conditions, I don't know, 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit, no water, no food, and, you know, trekking oversized tourists up steep hills to visit pink forts and stuff like that. Those elephants are really abused in that respect. So, no, I see this as being humane. I'm certainly not wanting to judge, but if they're going on a short trek in the morning, it makes a certain amount of sense, and then they've got the rest of the day to go and play as elephants do. I think that's potentially a really wonderful lifestyle for these guys that would have potentially been either at the end of a tranquilizer gun or potentially left to die in the wilderness. So you've given them a new lease of life. You've brought them to this wonderful new location where they've got views of Victoria Falls every day. I mean, what more could an elephant want besides some sugar?
No, Warren, make no mistake, you know, even people like Shane and myself, you know, from youngsters 20 years ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago when we first started out, perceptions change. You know, the world changes. Our own worldly views change. Would I do things the same way again? Possibly not. I might do them slightly differently. make no mistake, there's a lot of controversy around surrounding elephants. Unfortunately, as and we may be partly to blame, having purely just made it an activity or a product that people loved, we exposed more people to elephant safaris and working with elephants. And so a lot more places sprung up throughout Africa. There's a lot in South Africa. There's a few more in Botswana, a lot in Zimbabwe. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, not all of them are ethical. As you say, I personally, I've visited Thailand. I've seen what goes on there. My heart broke when I saw how some of the elephants were treated there, you know, absolutely abysmally. I can put my hand on my heart and say, you know, we were a family of young, enthusiastic safari people. We always intended to do the right thing, and I believe we did. Our elephants have always had a great lifestyle. They've had plenty of open space. They've never, ever worked too hard. An hour in the morning, maybe an hour in the afternoon, interacting with guests. Plenty of free time during the day. We, you know, lots of big open areas for them to traverse. Lots of interaction with wild animals.
So, but now you're enjoying good times with these Ellies. Your family's all involved. People come to you and say, "Hey, there's been another culling operation. We've got some more baby elephants that need some rescuing. Will you take them on?" And so all of a sudden, your four start to increase in size, not because they're reproducing, but because of the goodwill and the nature of the guys who are running this sanctuary now.
Yeah, Warren, and that's exactly right. You know, before we knew it, we had, you know, another four elephants, then we had another three elephants. Again, products of these culling operations, and the biggest problem with all these animals, and it's exactly the same as everyone thinks it's cute to get a baby monkey, you know, or a little night ape, or a baby kudu, or a bushbuck. Everything's great when it's a baby. And then at some stage, these animals grow up. And it doesn't matter whether it's a little vervet monkey or a bushbuck. Those things can be damn dangerous when they get big. They get protective. They get, males will get aggressive. They'll get territorial. And so a lot of these elephants that were, you know, we ended up with two elephants that had actually been swapped for two ostrich. That's how bad the situation got, you know. Various farmers had these animals, and one guy had too many elephants and not enough ostrich, and somebody had some ostrich. He said, I'll take two ostrich, you give me two elephants, you know. And eventually these two baby elephants ended up on this farm, and, you know, then they become six and seven, and then they're big, and then they break a fence and they go and crop raid next door, and the farmer next door gets grumpy, and before you know it, there's a problem. You can't keep big animals like this in domesticated conditions, farmlands, areas that you don't have lots of area for these animals to wander about in. And that's how suddenly we got more of these things thrust upon us, where, you know, turned out to, it was a great idea at the time, but hey, hang on, these things are a problem now. What can I do with them? And so we became known as a place where you could get rid of some problem elephants if you had them. Apart from taking on extra orphans, our own National Parks Department realized that once we had figured out the correct milk formula, how to feed a baby elephant, you know, that will drink 60 liters of milk a day for 2 years. It's a huge undertaking. Yeah. Apart from the cost, it's the mixing of the milk or whatever. Once you figured out how to do that, you can save a baby elephant that's been abandoned, you know, for whatever reason in a national park. So suddenly we were a bunch of babies that were abandoned for whatever reason. Our National Parks Department would say, "Hey, by the way, here's another baby elephant we need you to look after." And, you know, before we knew it, we had 23, 25 elephants on the property wandering around. So
yeah, and nobody's paying you to keep those elephants, right?
Exactly right, Warren. There are so many organizations out there doing anti-poaching work and really good work with wildlife, but there's a lot of places that also need money, you know, and it's a lot more difficult to access than you would imagine. You know, you say, "Hey, I've got an elephant sanctuary and some baby elephants that need rescuing. Give me some money." Well, you've got to work really hard at it. You've got to be really good at marketing, and you've got to be the right kind of person. Remember, we were youngsters, we were kids. we knew nothing about marketing. You know, people wanted to come to Africa. It was, in our eyes, it was a privilege. Come see what we've got to show you. You know, we knew nothing about marketing, how to access money. So it was a struggle, and keeping these things fed and housed and enough staff was a problem. So yeah, we needed to get some tourists in to come and interact with the elephants, throw some money at them, and hopefully we'd be able to keep doing what we did. It's changed a little bit from then. We've grown up, we've learned a lot over the years. But we still have 18 elephants under our charge at the moment, and some of them are on a soft release program. So we've finally got round to a position where some of our elephants are actually wandering on our property, no longer being housed and fed by us. They're free ranging on the property. We're encouraging them to stay away from us. Once they're out there 2 or 3 years, and we've taught them how to be wild again, taught them to stay away from people, taught them not to come looking to us for food, and they're fending for themselves. Hopefully then we'll be able to take them and release them back into a place like Wangi, or, you know, a remote park, Kazuma, or somewhere like that. Once again, though, those places are full of elephants.
Yeah. You know?
Apart from the fact that some places in Africa are short of elephants, we in Zimbabwe are not. Us, Botswana, Zambia, we have lots of elephants. So finding a place to relocate to, not as easy as you would imagine. But we'll keep on going, and ultimately our intention is that all our elephants will be rehabilitated and released.
I mean, that's a huge goal, and particularly when, as you say, where do you release them? I mean, it's not just a case of releasing. You've got to get them to that destination as well, which once again costs a fortune of money. You have had some releases along the way, though. Is that true?
Correct. Yeah. We have. We've learned as we've gone along. We had some releases in Wangi that weren't that successful, to be honest. Created a bit of problems.
What does an unsuccessful release look like?
It's an elephant that is released prematurely into an area that, as I mentioned earlier before, hasn't really got it out of his system that he shouldn't go near people looking for food and companionship and water. So you release an elephant into an area and you say, there's lots of elephants there, go and be a wild elephant. Well, he doesn't want to be with wild elephants because he doesn't know how to be a wild elephant. You know, the big bulls out there beat up younger bulls. They chase them away. The cow herds don't just accept a young cow elephant wandering in. So it's a tough world out there if you're not born into a social system or you've been around and know how to be wild, to be honest, Warren. You know, we've trained these things to be domesticated, and thrusting them out into the wild and saying, off you go. It really is pretty tough. And, we've had a couple of instances where we had to release a few bulls into Wangi. One wandered out into a communal area and ended up getting destroyed by a group of hunters. Mm. Another one went into a national parks area and broke down a national parks game scout's hut looking for food, and the scouts were terrified and they ended up shooting him. So that was, 15 years ago when we were in our infancy, and we've realized since then, hey, this is not an overnight thing that you can just get involved with elephants and, you know, think you're doing the right thing and say, off you go and be an elephant, you know. So it's we've had some tears along the way, but we've learned. We've had some successful releases subsequently. We went into Botswana probably 5 years ago. The original, I mentioned a guy called Randall Moore, who was an American who brought some elephants back from circuses in America. Back into Botswana, a very complicated process. He started out in East Africa, got all the permits, arrived in East Africa. The government said, no, turn around, go back to America. The poor elephants were shipped all the way back again. Eventually, he got back down into South Africa and took the elephants into the Pilanesberg, which is the area you were talking about earlier. Spent a few years there, and then he eventually moved up into Botswana. So he really pioneered African elephants, you know, being domesticated back in Africa. This operation got into a little bit of trouble a few years back, and so we were asked to go in and assist, you know. So we spent a couple of years in Botswana helping out with that operation. One of the first things we did was we identified a couple of elephants that were just really never going to be safe to work around. You know, they'd had some tough years beforehand. Were a little bit difficult to be around safely. And so we engineered a release there, but we did it correctly this time. You know, we took them out into the wild. We created a big paddock area. We rehabilitated them over a period of time. We got them used to living away from us. And ultimately, we opened the fences and let them go. And they wandered off into the Okavango, which is a magnificent area for any wildlife to live in. And that's been a great success story. You know, they're living very happily with joined up with some wild elephants, and they're doing really well.
That's actually a really pretty awesome story, because those elephants came out of zoos, right, or circuses, where I mean, they couldn't have been more divorced from their natural environment than through those environments. So that is really terrific that you're able to achieve that.
Look. The original ones, by the time they got across, were quite elderly. Well, they were certainly middle-aged, and they'd lived 20 years, 25 years in Botswana. So the original circus elephants were never released themselves. There was a very famous elephant, Abu. I'm sure you may have heard of him. Most of the world have heard of Abu. And he was one of the original elephants. Abu, another female, Kathy. They were too habituated. They'd lived too long in zoos. They could never really be released. So it was their offspring and some of the other elephants that had lived with them that we ultimately managed to release back into a wild state, Warren.
I see.
We did a similar exercise in South Africa. We had some elephants in the Pilansberg, close to the Pilansberg, in a little reserve called the Letsatsing. Close to Pilansberg, and we released seven elephants onto a huge private estate on the Botswana border between South Africa and Botswana, and that went very successfully as well. So we're excited that we think we know how to do it now. It takes time, it takes money, it takes effort, once you release them, it takes monitoring for 2 years, making sure they're okay. It's you know, people on the ground, radio equipment, vehicles, money. It's not a cheap business, this. You don't undertake something like this lightly.
You guys and your care and respect for those elephants have gone a long way. I mean, you've developed a sort of a veterinary service at the Elephant Camp now, a sanctuary that stretches beyond just caring for the elephants. You've got all sorts of other creatures that Wild Horizons now nurtures along and saves and rescues and rehabilitates.
Yes, Warren. Probably 15 years ago now, we formed what was then called the Wild Horizons Wildlife Sanctuary, and that's changed into the Vic Falls. Not Wildlife Sanctuary. The Wild Horizons Wildlife Trust, and over the years, that's changed into the Victoria Falls Wildlife Trust. And the primary goal was really just to provide a vehicle, a method that people could look at and donate some money, learn about what we were trying to achieve. We were doing a lot of anti-poaching work, particularly on elephants, but it spread very rapidly to every other animal. Getting involved in assisting national parks and logistics issues, things like that. So we started very small, just as part of the Wild Horizons group. And it grew so quickly that eventually we changed it into the Victoria Falls Wildlife Trust. And it's going very strong at the moment. It's based on our property, on the Wild Horizons Wildlife Sanctuary, headed up by a very able couple, Roger and Jessica Perry, who have been with the trust for probably 10, 12 years now. And we have one of the eminent wildlife vets in Africa, Dr. Chris Foggan, who works with us, and they do a phenomenal job. A great amount of work is done on human-wildlife conflict work. You know, we have a whole team of people out there trying to educate villagers about not just killing every elephant that comes into, you know, the field of maize at night, not spearing the lions that come and hassle your cattle, trying to work out mitigation plans where you can educate people that wildlife actually has the potential to generate tourism, money, and let's try and do things differently, you know? So that's just a small arm of the Wildlife Trust. Huge amount of work done on desnaring. We have, as I said, Roger and Dr. Foggan are both qualified dangerous drugs handlers. We go out, we get reports of animals that are caught in snares, whether they're elephants, buffalo, giraffe, the whole range, down to little warthogs in the village itself. They'll go out, dart these animals, take the snares off, doctor them, do whatever they can to put them, in as good a condition as they can, and monitor them afterwards. So a phenomenal amount of good work done.
What sort of range would these guys have? I mean, the area around Vic Falls, obviously you've got the Vic Falls National Park and you've got the Zambezi National Park. How far beyond those parks would they go to save an animal or to get involved in a snare patrol or an anti-poaching patrol?
Oh, absolutely, as far as they need to go, to be honest. Our Wildlife Trust has been called right down into the southeastern part of the country, down onto the huge wildlife reserves down there. Dr. Foggan does a huge amount of work with rhino that are on all these conservancies, dehorning campaigns, to try and protect them against poaching, veterinary work with any particularly of the rhino or any other the big animals that are in need down there. The guys have flown off to Kariba, to Matusa Donna, answering the call of rescuing animals and snares there, been across into Botswana to assist in Botswana companies that have problems, vets in Botswana who need a hand, who need specialized expertise. So the guys are prepared to go anywhere, and they are a hugely dedicated team. We have built a laboratory on the property at the moment, at the Vic Falls Wildlife Trust. A laboratory that's very, very well equipped. We have a qualified laboratory technician. We do all kinds of lab work now. One of the only labs in the area, the whole Khaza area, which is the Kavango Zambezi Frontier Park system, which covers Angola, Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Namibia. One of the biggest transfrontier parks. We are the registered veterinary clinic for that. So, wow. Yeah, they do a phenomenal job, a lot of work. But, again, like everybody, funds are always the limiting factor. We have people out there trying to raise money all the time, and they do an incredible job on often very limited resources.
Well, I'm just sitting here listening to you and thinking about the scope of the job, and my mind is racing, and I'm thinking, 20-odd elephants, a task force that's based up there that goes out at an instant to go and rescue an animal, can cross the border into Botswana, can reach down into southern Zim, go up into Zambia, wherever. I mean, how are you funding all of this? What are these operations costing a year? I mean, you must be talking over $1 million, surely.
Absolutely. The Wildlife Trust on its own is reaching those sort of figures rapidly. The more work it does, the more well-known it becomes, and the more people reach out to us to try and assist, we have an arm in the UK, we have an arm in the US raising funds for us. We have people based in those areas constantly out fundraising. We tap all sorts of sources. We work closely with World Wildlife Fund, any of the bigger wildlife groups. We're out there scratching around for every penny we can, One of the things that we do really benefit from is having access to the Wild Horizons lodges, the elephant operation, and some of the other products in Victoria Falls who've come in and offered to assist where they can. And some places have levies, bed levies, where we raise a couple of dollars for every guest that stays in the lodge. It goes towards the Wildlife Trust. We sell curios. We sell elephant footprints. Our guests who stay at our lodges contribute financially to the trust. Part of a guest stay at the elephant camp or at the Old Rift Lodge is they will visit the Vic Falls Wildlife Trust laboratory facility. They'll meet the lab technicians. They'll see the injured and orphaned animals that we house there at any given time. We've got half a dozen small animals ranging from bushbuck to vultures to, you know, birds that have hit power lines to all kinds of things that are being looked after. And so we encourage the guests to get as involved as possible. We've had some lovely donations from guests who love the work that the Wildlife Trust are doing. And we slog at it from every angle that we can, Warren.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, I was thinking about those elephant camps, 24 beds or so. You've got 30 beds or so at Old Drift, and Mbabala's got, 14 beds. I mean, it's going to help a certain amount, but it's certainly not going to cover the lion's share of the cost. And I suppose in times like this, it must be fairly traumatic for you guys on that side managing the budget when there's no tourism coming in.
Absolutely. A time like this as well, as you said before, it's a time like the world has never really seen in modern times. We're all upside down at the moment, and certainly things like the Wildlife Trust will take a beating with no tourists. Difficult to anticipate when we get back into the full swing of things in Vic Falls. It may be as late as the end of this year into the first 3-4 months of next year before, you know, tourists come back in any numbers. So certainly things like the Wildlife Trust will really be struggling for funds. You know, we still have salaries to pay. We have veterinarians that, you know, they need to earn a crust. We have drugs to purchase. We have, particularly at a time like this, in a crisis like we have in Zimbabwe, the poaching really is at an unprecedented high at the moment. The anti-poaching guys are working flat out, desnaring, picking up snares in the bush, you know, darting animals. It's crisis time.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've read a few conflicting articles. There was one that came out of South Africa just a little while ago saying that the poaching incidents in the Kruger National Park was down, particularly in the month of April going into May. And the author of that article argued that it wasn't so much a case of not that the tourists' feet and eyes on the ground were discouraging poaching, just economic situations across the border in Mozambique and in South Africa where confinement has kept poachers locked up type thing. I don't know how true that is. Then there was another article that I read by a ex-marine anti-poaching dude over here who was chomping at the bit to get back to South Africa because on the reserve that he works in, there has been an absolute and utter flare-up of rhino poaching, and he needed to get back to motivate his troops, so to say, to curtail it. I've also read in Botswana that there's been a rise in poaching incidents in the month of April. 6 or 7 rhinos are poached.
Correct.
Argument there is being made that with tourism drying up, you don't have the discouraging effect of travelers on the ground, and poachers seem to have open season. I'm glad you brought the subject up, because I'm curious to know, is that really true? Eyes and ears on the ground, it's having an impact. Poachers are active. Is this in big game areas, or are they really poaching for the pot at home, which I could very well understand?
You know, in Zim, it's a little bit of both, to be honest. As you're probably aware, we're in a bit of an economic crisis in the country. Apart from the latest pandemic, things are pretty tough. We have fairly high unemployment. This has only made it worse. A lot more people are going to be out of jobs. So it's a combination of things. There's definitely an element of commercial poaching out there. As you say, undoubtedly, parks that have got lodges and a people presence in them all the time, the poaching is really definitely curtailed. There is no doubt in my mind about that. You have cars driving around, you have game guides taking people out on safari. Just the mere presence of people around will definitely inhibit poachers from moving into public areas. Take away all those safari drives, take away all those people, take away the game guides that are out there every day. Poachers have free rein, and we've definitely noticed an increase over this very short period of just the crisis that we're in at the moment. Subsistence poaching, times are tough here. People need to feed their families. we've noticed subsistence poaching going on the rise. And along with that, you know, often that turns very quickly into commercial poaching. And by commercial, it's not only always a rhino horn or an elephant tusk they're after. It's meat. You know, you can make a lot of money out of shooting a bunch of animals in a park and selling them to unscrupulous butchers and raising some money. Eh?
Yeah. Well, I suppose it is a desperate time, and I would imagine.
It's a tough time.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to think of these national parks that we have as being sort of the grain baskets for the poor in times of need. And I wonder, just this is a random thought, I wonder sometimes if our ecosystems are viable enough to be able to support a little bit of a peak in bushmeat poaching in hard times, and whether that they would be hampered in the long run. I don't know. It's just an interesting thought.
There's enough controversy in the world without raising that, eh?
Talking about controversies, the last time I was up in Victoria Falls, a huge crocodile crossed the road from the Soho Sun towards the Ilala Lodge. Right. I would imagine that without too many tourists running around the town now, you would be seeing a lot more. I mean, there were elephants just outside towards the national park, Zambezi National Park. There were buffalo right at the bottom of the road from Safari Lodge. Are you seeing much wildlife activity or more than usual wildlife activity in the town?
Absolutely, undoubtedly. And sadly, I'm not seeing them because I'm being a good boy and staying locked down. But obviously, with the current situation, we've had to have most of our security personnel out just, you know, minding the stores and minding the lodges, and security have the ability to get around and look after things for us, our boats and bits and pieces like that. And we have these security briefings from our guys every morning and every evening just to tell us that everything's okay and the boats haven't floated away. But the one thing they really have commented on is the elephants are taking back the town, you know, and absolutely, you know, with no traffic around and no tourists walking up and down, the elephants are back, and they've been wandering right through the middle of the village. The buffalo have been coming into town. Funny enough, this morning I was lying on my couch early this morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I heard lions calling. And they've been coming quite close to the edge of town. My house is towards the edge of the village, and quite often the lions come up onto an airstrip area, probably as a crow flies 2 kilometers from me here, a kilometer and a half. And you'll hear the lions calling, and, you know, the zebras calling and buffalo. So, yeah, absolutely. The animals are moving, and it doesn't take long, hey? If we disappeared, the animals would inherit the earth pretty quickly, Warren.
Well, that's thrilling to know. I mean, there have been a lot of pictures posted on social media of leopards being sighted in areas of the Western Cape where they've been known to occur but never seen in sort of decades. And now there are these frequent sightings. There are sightings of things like porcupines and other creatures moving through hotel gardens where they've never been seen before. So I'm actually quite thrilled in a way to see this revolution of wildlife taking back their cities. Obviously, it's a temporary thing, unfortunately. Well, fortunately for us in the tourism industry, but unfortunately for the animals. But yeah, it's fascinating just to see how this impasse has affected so many different natural biomes. I read an article just this morning about the quality of the air in India and how their reduced consumption of fossil-driven fuels has allowed the countryside literally clear up almost overnight. I suppose if COVID has a silver lining, it's the environment that's benefiting.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's all sorts of wonderful stories out there of things that you would never have believed possible, you know, just in this short time. And it always amazes me how quickly things can turn around, how quickly they can bounce back. And maybe, Warren, as you say, I mean, you never want to say that this is a good thing that's happened, but if there ever is a silver lining, not only the benefit that is maybe given to some of the air pollution, some of the wildlife that's being moving around, but maybe even just for ourselves, you know, and make us think a little bit more about each other. You know, I've definitely noticed amongst friends of mine, some of my family, you know, people are being a little bit more caring of each other and taking a little bit more time, you know, over each other. It'll be some interesting changes that we'll go into after this. Eh? I'm hoping that we won't just go back to same old. I'm not sure it'll ever be entirely the same again.
No, I think you're spot on there, Craig. Just from what I've read, the conversations that I've been having, normal is no more. What we were accustomed to is going to be entirely different. There's a big movement from what I can see to restore sustainable practices. It's an opportunity for companies and not just in the tourism industry, but all over in every industry to become a lot more environmentally sustaining, which I think is very positive. Hopefully we all pass through it and can get to that point and protect our planet better than we have in the past.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's a lot of things we've done very wrong in the past, and hopefully this is a bit of a wake-up call for all of us, you know? I certainly think it was time for a mindset change. If you have an interest in wildlife and what's going on in Africa, and particularly in Zimbabwe and around Victoria Falls, click on to the Vic Falls Wildlife Trust website. If you forget that name, just think about Wild Horizons. Go on to Wild Horizons, and that'll lead you through to the Vic Falls Wildlife Trust as well. You can see the range of things that we do, our lodges, where we came from, the people that are involved in Wild Horizons. And hopefully we'll get to see some tourists again fairly soon. We look forward to that time. Most of us are getting pretty bored. We've mended everything that our wives wanted mended in the house. And we really need to get back to work.
Well, I'm doing my best for you guys over this side, so I am working, but I will admit to having one of the most raked lawns in the neighborhood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I never knew there was such a slope to my garden until I had to push the lawnmower uphill. Anyway. Craig, Warren. Thanks. Chatting to you, huh?
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
Excellent. Okay. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Craig. Cheers, man. Bye.
Well. Bye-bye. Ciao.